Hey, it's Molly. Kai is on assignment. So this week, I know, right? For once, Kai is the one on assignment and I'm the one recording for you. This week, we are sharing one of our favorite Make Me Smart interviews with you, my personal obsession. It is a conversation with a riverboat pilot named Debbie Dempsey. She recently retired from piloting ships across the Columbia River Bar. Now, looking back, the reason that I love this interview so much is because it was focused on one person's amazing job and then all of the wisdom they've accumulated while doing it. And that is something we want to do more of in season two. Just that little extra special, interesting stuff. So let us know about someone in your life with an incredible job, or, you know, if it's you, tell us that too, or a job you've always wanted to know more about. Kai and I will be back in 2 weeks with one more remix episode. And then we are so close to the launch of season two. So close. Thank you for all the great feedback you've been sending us about the podcast. If you have not written to us yet with your thoughts, your dreams, your hopes for season two, email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Hello, everyone. I am Molly Wood.
I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Welcome to Make Me Smart. We are joined, as we always are, by you because, as we like to say around these parts, none of us is as smart as all of us.
I like to say it around all the parts. We're doing a rare Friday taping. Yeah. We are not taping the show on our normal Tuesday. And so if you hear a little bit of, like, I don't know, exhaustion and rancor, it's just...
Wait, were the microphones on before we started this? Oh, my God.
It's the length of the... I'm in an awesome mood because it's Friday. But by the time you hear this, yes. Mr. Kai Ruzdahl will sadly not be on vacation. He will be... out in the field.
South Carolina.
Out in the field. Yes. Oh, my goodness. South Carolina in July.
I don't know what I was thinking, but whatever. I love my job.
It's going to be pretty hot. What are you reporting on out there?
Globalization, of course.
Oh.
Yeah. You remember Lindsey Graham the other day said at a BMW plant ceremony, he said, listen, if you want it, they can say all they want in the White House about globalization. Globalization works, and if you want to see it, come to South Carolina. So we're going to South Carolina.
What a good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I wish I was going with you because I totally want to do the... They have like a BMW driving program there because that's where they make the BMWs.
As it happens, we're going to the BMW plant.
Come
I
on.
Know. I know.
You know, it's not too late to bring me.
I don't know actually that I'm going to get to zip around the track in a BMW. But yeah, but that's where we're going.
Do
we're going
it.
To the BMW plant. Little known fact about Molly Wood. People who've been listening to Molly on podcasts for a long time probably know this, but I was gobsmacked to learn not all that very long ago that Molly is a ginormous car geek, that she has really expensive tires on her car, right? Can I say this on the radio? Can I say this on the podcast? I can.
Yeah, go ahead. So expensive that I'm going to have to sell the car.
That's right. That's right. She's just all, she's all kinds of car geek, which I think is cool. Anyway, so I'll be in South Carolina by the time you hear this. Molly will be off driving somewhere. But what we are going to talk about instead today, just so you have something in your feed, and because it was a cool thing that Molly came up with, honestly, full credit here, is a thing that she did on her summer vacation. True story.
It's true. Yeah. And actually, this is the interview that you are going to hear very shortly is basically the one that I kept saying was the model for the entire show.
Yeah.
Like when people would say, what do you think Make Me Smart should be about? I'd say, okay, let me tell you about this thing that happened. But I'm actually going to start with my most recent summer vacation, the one you also heard about on the podcast, because apparently I have no boundaries, when I went to Montana. And I went there for a family wedding. And there's no like less awkward way to say this, but at this family wedding, I was hecka famous.
Wow.
And yeah, and a lot of people had questions about Kai Ruzdahl, obviously.
Oh,
and it was, you know, it was kind of awkward and funny, and people kept coming and wanting to talk to me. And finally, I said to somebody, like late in the evening, there was a sort of small group hanging around, and I said...
Had a couple, right? You'd had a couple.
You know, yeah.
Maybe.
How does it feel to be the local celebrity? And I was like, absurd, because the only thing that we do as journalists, I was like, all I do is meet and tell people stories about people like the bride.
Right.
Who... is phenomenal, this incredible, fascinating wildlife biologist who like went all over Africa to study endangered animals and was the only woman on these trips and was sleeping in the cab of trucks and, you know, fending off lions. And is, I mean, like what we do is meet people who are way more interesting than us.
That is so true.
And tell stories about them.
Yep.
Phil David Carr from the New York Times always used to say that journalism is not a real job. And my version of that is to say we exist to be a conduit to more interesting people than we are. Which gets me to last summer's vacation, where I went with my son. I rented an RV, which I highly recommend. Super fun family vacation you can take the dog. We drove up to the tip of Northern Oregon and stayed at Fort Stevens. And this was my first visit to the Columbia River Bar, which is where the Columbia River meets the Pacific Ocean. And apparently it's bonkers. It's like this really choppy river, and you can see a shipwreck right on the beach. It's not a museum or anything. You just walk right up to it and hang out on the shipwreck. And then the riverside, which is a little calmer. And fun fact, our producer Jenny just went on a summer vacation to the same place, and she like got a little sound to the river.
Is that you jumping in the water, Jenny? What is that? Or is that a wave? That's a wave.
It's so nice.
Is that a wave?
It's probably a wave.
All right. So that's what it sounds like.
It is not peaceful at all. It is not relaxing like that. Apparently, the Columbia River Bar is this crazy, dangerous crossing. And what I found out is that there are these people whose whole job it is to pilot ships through the crossing, whether they're coming in from the Pacific Ocean or out from the Columbia River Bar. It is mandatory that a Columbia River Bar pilot get on your boat and drive you through because it's so dangerous. So I got obsessed, and ever since then, I have wanted to call someone up and find out what this is all about, and we did.
Green Douglas fir where the waters cut through, down our wild mountains and canyons she flew, Canadian Northwest to the ocean so blue, it's roll on, Columbia, roll on,
roll so. That song is because of this. Columbia River starts in Canada, goes like 1,200-ish miles, gets into the Pacific Ocean near Astoria, Oregon. And about my extent of this podcast is there's a lot of cargo that goes in and out, right? And that's where we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the whole deal. Yeah. It's a really, you know, it's a huge crossing. And there's a lot of economic impact in terms of all of the stuff that comes in and out of here, even though it is super dangerous. In fact, it is one of the most difficult channels in the world to navigate. The river's flowing out to sea. The ocean's rolling in the opposite direction. So obviously you get big waves. But there are also all these sandbars and shoals that are constantly forming and reforming. They actually call it the Graveyard of the West because since 1792, there have been 2,000 shipwrecks that have killed 700 people. And like I said, it's so dangerous. You gotta get a person.
Gotta get a pilot, right? And these are specially trained people who go out from the shore. They climb up on these ships and they pilot them in. That's the deal.
And it's insane because they climb up on these ships. Yeah. They go out there in little tiny boats and they climb up them and then they go up and down these ladders and like 40-foot waves. It's bananas. So I was obsessed with this. This is just like one of these things I wanted to know more about. And that, to me, was like the entire goal of Make Me Smart.
Mm-hmm.
Our amazing producers went out and found Debbie Dempsey, who is a retired Columbia River bar pilot. And there is really no other word for this woman than badass.
I'm completely confident she could kick my ass. I'm just saying that.
Yeah, right? 100%.
Yeah.
She was the first woman to ever graduate from a U.S. Maritime Academy, the first woman to ever attain, and she'll talk about this, an international unlimited tonnage master's license. She's going to explain that later, and you're going to love it. Hmm. And she was the first female Columbia River bar pilot, now retired.
Wow. There is, as you might have gathered from that little preamble there, a lot of nautical lingo that goes in this interview. So if you like to know what folks are talking about, we've got a listen-along glossary. If you're not driving, hit pause, makemesmart.org, and it will be right there for you. And if, you know, you can't do it because you're driving, go back later and do it. Anyway, here you go.
So when a ship comes through the Columbia River Bar, do they have to have a bar pilot navigate them through?
Yes, that's correct.
Every ship, even like a big Navy destroyer?
Well, for a U.S. Navy destroyer, that it would be optional. That's a government ship. Do they always take a Columbia River Bar pilot? Yes, they do.
Hmm.
It is very cheap insurance. Anywhere where you go around the world, into a port, into a harbor entrance, anywhere, you pick up a local pilot.
Huh.
It's very cheap insurance. We speak the language. We know the territory. We produce the chart. We had to produce the chart for our license. Literally, they give you the coordinates and everything, the parallels and the longitudes, and you redraw that chart from memory, all the depths, everything. So it's in our head. Someone coming to the Columbia River Bar for the first time does not know the currents, doesn't know the water as intricately as we do, and they pick up a pilot. And it is compulsory pilotage. If I go into Izmir, Turkey on a commercial ship, which I did for 18 years before becoming a Columbia Bar pilot, I would pick up an Izmir pilot.
Huh. You alluded to it a minute ago. How does one become a Columbia River bar pilot other than drawing that map? What do you have to do?
To become a Columbia River bar pilot, you need a lot of seagoing experience. It almost requires it, and it could be, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think the most seagoing experience required of anywhere in the world because of how dangerous it is. You must have 2 years offshore sea time as master. And that doesn't mean you just go out for a couple of years and you're master. It takes you, 15, 18 years to build up through the ranks from third mate, second mate, chief mate, master. And this is the unlimited license. This is deep sea. And then a couple of years sea time on that license. So literally, I went to sea for 18 years before I was recruited as a Columbia River bar pilot.
Wow.
We are deep sea masters.
Wow. And then the unlimited license means you can actually command any ship, right? Any type of ship, anywhere?
That's exactly right. Anywhere, any ocean, any size. That's correct.
So worst case, you're taking a ship through and past the Columbia River bar, and something happens. You run aground, you hit another ship, whatever it is. You're having the worst day of your life. Who's on the hook, you or the captain of the ship?
Both.
Aha.
That's why they hired the experts, okay?
Yeah, totally.
So how often do you read about that happening? Not very often.
Yeah, well, not so often, right?
Exactly right. So that's what we are. We are experts in that particular body of water, literally. We really are. And we can go aboard any type of ship and bring it across the Columbia River bar safely. And if we always have plan B in the back of our head in case something goes wrong. What if you lose the plant? Something like that. So
What plant?
The engines.
Yeah, what plant?
Oh, the engine, the power plant. The power plant.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. I'm like, plant? What?
One thing I found amazing hearing about what you do is how it's not just the actual piloting through the bar that's really dangerous. It's how you get on and off the ships themselves. Can you talk us through that?
That's exactly right. And of course, for the Columbia River bar, it's probably the most dangerous place to get on and off a ship. And there's two ways that we do it. We either do it from a pilot boat, and these boats are 76 feet long themselves. And what a pilot boat does is come up and match the speed of the ship, and you literally transfer from the deck of the pilot boat onto a ladder, not a fixed ladder, a ladder that is moving, hanging over the side of the ship. And then you scurry up the ladder onto the deck of the ship. Bear in mind that the a flat, calm day on the Columbia River bar, maybe there's a couple a year, but the ship is moving, the ladder's moving, and the pilot boat is moving. All of these are moving. And so you time when you transfer from that deck to the ladder. The other way that we board ships, and we've been doing it I think since 2005, is by helicopter.
Hmm.
And 70% of our transfers are being done by helicopter, and 30% of those are land-ons, and the other 70% are you're being lowered, not dropped. People say drop. No, you never want to drop a pilot from a helicopter. They're being lowered on a wire to the deck of the ship.
On the theory that global shipping is not a Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 kind of job, what are your hours like?
Well, your hours are not specific. It just depends on the volume of traffic and the time. Yes, it's 24/7.
Yeah.
Ships move at night. They also move on Saturdays and Sundays. And it's 365 days a year. Mm. But you can be in the night rotation, you can be in the day rotation, whatever. Or you can be rotating through days and nights. It just depends on the volume of traffic.
Well, and you had, I read, a pretty harrowing experience where you fell in at 1:40 a.m. into the, deep black cold water.
That's correct.
Can you tell us about that? I mean, that's just reading that is one of the most terrifying things I can even imagine. You were like plucked right out.
It is terrifying. The last thing a pilot wants to do is be what we call in the drink. And so, yes, I was, and I'm very good on the ladder, considered to be one of the better pilots on the ladder. I'm athletic. And what you do is you, I was disembarking from an outbound loaded ship, and it was a job where I wasn't really appreciating the captain of this Greek ship, and I couldn't wait to get off that ship. And when I became a Columbia Bar pilot, the pilot that I replaced, he taught me something. He said, before you leave the bridge to go down on that deck and get on that pilot boat, get on that ladder, tie your shoes. And the reason you tie your shoes is to remind yourself to be mindful of your feet. And you know what? That's one of the few times I did not tie my shoes. So I went down there to jump off the ladder onto the deck of the pilot boat. It wasn't bad conditions, really and truly. It was like only 10 footers. And the visibility was good. And you watch the motion of the pilot boat alongside the ship, and you make your move. And the move that you do to disembark from these ships is like you are Tarzan, me, Jane. And you jump on these two ropes that are called man ropes, and you slide down these man ropes to the deck. You leave the pilot ladder, and you kick away from it, slide down the ropes to the deck of the pilot boat. So I watched, made my move, and we use these aluminum pilot boats now that only draw 3 feet. They're very lively out there on the ocean. And the pilot boat itself found a hole and fell an additional 6 feet away from me. I actually was working, I'd had a knee injury and had a brace on my knee, and I had a split second of indecision, thinking, wow, if I let go of these man ropes and land in a heap on the deck of the pilot boat, I'm really going to hurt myself. And that was enough to bring me back alongside the ship. And by this time, you're at the bottom of the man ropes hanging below the pilot ladder. And eventually, I couldn't hold myself and just dropped between the ship and the pilot boat.
Wow.
And everything's moving in motion at about 11 knots. And of course, you become a stationary object as soon as you hit the water.
Yeah.
And so they're quickly away from you, and it's quite black out there. And they throw all their lights, the ship through a life ring, ship through an orange smoke, and luckily didn't hit me on the head with the life ring. And the pilot boat went into action, and we didn't know that things were going wrong. With they throw you a bag that has a line in it. And at the end of the line is a horseshoe collar. And you get the bag and pull the line out, and you pull yourself to the horseshoe, put the horseshoe around you, and you climb up the 7 feet of freeboard. They put the rope up over a davit.
7 feet.
And there you go. But what they didn't know is that the horseshoe was caught in the jets. These are jet engine boats.
Oh.
So it was exactly. So what they had to do was encircle me with the line and haul me up against the boat. And that's the only time I got my head wet, was when I was alongside the boat going up and down with it and kind of getting sucked underneath the starboard quarter of the boat.
Wow.
Because the jets aren't engaged, but there's a lot of froth, and you get sucked under there. The boots I actually wore that night still have the bottom paint on them.
The paint from the bottom of the boat.
Well, yeah, from kicking off to keep myself from getting sucked under there and getting whacked on the head.
Which is not where you want to be. So you're retired now. Do you miss it?
I am retired. What I miss is I miss driving the ships. It's quite exhilarating. And the camaraderie I had with crews that I got to meet from there coming into the Columbia River repeatedly. And bear in mind that 98% of the traffic that comes into the United States is on foreign flag.
Yeah.
And so, but the repeat customers you really develop a relationship with, so that's what I miss. Not that I'm not busy.
I have a feeling that you keep yourself pretty busy. I would imagine that, though, you alluded to this too, that sometimes the relationship with the captain of the ship is not always ideal. I mean, I have this picture in mind of, you know, maybe a macho Navy pilot, no offense.
Hey, I'm sitting right here.
Or, you know, somebody who thinks I could totally handle this, giving you the stink eye.
Well, that's absolutely true. And it's not too long ago that I was assigned to a big container ship, 952 feet long, coming into the Columbia River. And I can't remember whether I boarded by pilot boat or helicopter, climb up to the bridge. It's evening time, and I get us started in and introduce myself right away to the captain. And the captain's not saying anything to me. So things calm down, and we're headed in. And eventually he says to me, he looks at me and says, "But you are a woman."
Wow.
And this is not too many years ago. And I just wanted to unzip my jacket, open it up, give him a hug, and said, "I love you, Captain. You noticed."
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, man. Hello, HR?
But he'd said, he said nothing going in. And, of course, we get into Astoria. It's one of the areas where you have two pilotage. And the river pilot relieved me, a friend of mine, who gave me a hug and a kiss. And I go down, and Elroy told me later that after I left the bridge, the captain said to him, "That pilot was a woman." And the kicker is, of course, he has to do an outbound leg, right?
Oh,
after
man.
He finishes his discharge. There at that particular time, there was one woman river pilot out of their 44 pilots. And she is blonde and petite, has a higher voice than I do, probably had red nail polish and red lipstick. Guess who his pilot was outbound? It was Captain McIntyre.
As it should be.
Exactly.
I love her.
That was a nice little interview. I'd forgotten that.
I mean,
we did it a while ago, but yeah, she was great. She was great.
Yeah, I mean, what an interesting person.
Yeah.
Just and awesome. Again, if you want to see what some of those terms mean, because I know not everybody is nautically minded, and our job here is to make us smart on all kinds of things. You should check out our listen along glossary at makemesmart.org. You could even like rewind it and listen along.
Yeah. We'll be back in a sec. Got to pay some bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
So like we said, these shows and our entire careers are really just conduits for fascinating people. That totally describes Debbie. And it also describes everybody who listens to this show, who is so smart and interesting, and they do such cool things. And I just felt like the last few shows, especially the reaction to The Righteous Mind, could not have proven that better.
Yeah, we got a lot of informed feedback. As Molly said, we talked about Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, last week. Lots and lots and lots of people wrote in with thoughts about the book and suggestions for the next book and thoughts about what we had to say. Here's some of them.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
Okay, so many people had things to say about evolution and genetics. If there were two trigger words in our entire conversation, during our discussion, just to set this up, I said that one of the soul-crushing discoveries in the book was that our political leanings are genetic and are genetically determined. And in the book, Haidt talks about how those leanings, those genetic leanings, can be reinforced by social responses. You know, we may respond a certain way to certain input from the world around us and then find ourselves ending up in a direction that is, you know, along with our genes, either liberal or conservative leaning. Suzanne G. and many others said, "Surely many people have written to inform you that genetics are far from immutable. Your genes can be influenced by the environment, including interactions with other beings, in a way that are passed on to generations. Far from a downer, Dr. Haidt's idea that much of our political and moral wiring is genetic means it's also mutable in a way that can be passed down but also influenced by your experiences. Check it out, epigenetics." Epigenetics is a whole other show, by the way, that I totally want to do.
I don't even know what that is.
It's like the idea that there are certain genetic behaviors that can be turned on or off, genetic expressions that can be turned on or off, and then once they're turned on or off, passed down.
Wow. Did you know that before we actually started talking about it?
Yeah, epigenetics is super interesting.
Wow.
Did I what?
Did you know that before?
Yeah, because you got to because it's in Seven Eves.
Is it really? I read that whole book.
Yeah, the whole back half of Seven Eves.
You know what's so funny? Is that when I read that book, Seven Eves by oh my God, what's his name? Come on, help me out.
Neal Stephenson.
Oh my God. I was like, oh, what an awesome space story this was. This was so cool. And rockets and the moon and stuff. And you get epigenetics is a thing about, oh man, I'm such a dork.
I got both of those. I'm so lame. The whole second path. Remember, like, she turns into, like, basically a different person. It's an epigenetic shift.
Oh, okay, for the record, I'm not that shallow and stupid. What a cool rocket story this was.
Clearly, no, our interests are being, our interests are on display here.
Oh, my God. All right, I'm not even doing the next letter. I know the next letter is mine to read, but I'm not doing it. Suffice it to say, there were a lot of comments. Right. You want to do it? Go ahead. I can't even.
So many. I bolded just the only that we got a very long email from Christian Gunning.
Yes.
Because, like, it was either people's feedback broadly was either about the genetic part and how that's not soul crushing because genes don't have to make you who you are, or the evolution part. So Christian Gunning writes, as a scientist and biologist, I feel compelled to comment on the discussion of evolution, which I felt had major factual issues. Both my wife and I are practicing scientists, research and teaching in evolutionary ecology, and we've talked at length about the media's treatment of evolution. The vast majority of evolutionary research is conducted on non-human organisms, which I did not know. And the applicability of these findings to humans is unclear at best. A great deal of work on humans is correlation-based with no modern ethical route to experimentally investigate causation. In addition, a great deal of disagreement exists within the scientific community with regards to the importance of different evolutionary processes. Long story short, both evolution and human culture are enormously complex, and the interactions between the two are poorly understood at present. To suggest otherwise is misleading. People basically took issue with Haidt's attempt to sort of revive group evolution as a theory.
Right.
From the science-y way, because you guys are super smart.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that came out of here, right? It's that, as we said at the beginning, there are people out there who know way more about the stuff we're going to talk about than we do. And this
so much more.
Was totally one. Here's one from Josh Warner. On the most recent podcast, Molly asked if there was a way to expand one's group if our natural inclination is group association and division. In my experience, he says, there is, and that's travel. I've had the profound luck to travel all over the world for my job and to befriend people everywhere. That experience has changed my perspective profoundly and caused me to view my associations less in regional or national terms and more from a global perspective. Unfortunately, I have no idea how we get everybody to start traveling more, but I've got a great recommendation for a hot pot restaurant in Chengdu. That would be in China if we can figure it out.
Oh, I could not agree more.
Yeah.
And finally, Michael Britton wrote, I've been listening to the show for a few months now, and every week you guys always manage to give me at least one useful nugget.
At least one? Goal, gosh, thanks, Michael.
At least one.
Thanks, Mike.
Epigenetics. Boom. Yeah. Case in point, he says.
Seven Eves. Oh, no, not that.
That's going on the book group because we already read it.
Yeah, that's right.
He said, this week I skipped most of the episode because I didn't read the book. Whoops.
Yeah, we didn't
you don't
think
have
about
to.
That.
He said, but in the mailbag, I learned about Macklemore's Glorious, which may very well be the greatest running song of all time. Keep up the great work and thanks. And I totally wrote back to him and said, dude, I had planned to take the dog on a walk because I bought some new trail running shoes. And I was like, I'm just going to break these in and we're going to walk.
Nice little walk.
And I put that song on and I was like, oh, dude, we are going for a run.
Wow. Good for you.
That song is the best. Awesome. And I played it like 5 times in a row. And that is that.
I am a non-headphone runner, but that's a whole different podcast.
Oh, really?
You don't
listen to any music when you run?
No, when I go out, it's me. Well, first of all, how do you hear cars or coyotes or bears coming up behind you? Because let's remember, I go running at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, right? So there's that. There's the, you know, survival thing. But also, I just want my thoughts, man. It's just, that's my time. And I don't need any of this Macklemore or anybody.
I like that.
Also, hey, you kids, get off my lawn. review us, if you would, please, on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend about this podcast and write to us. Write to us, write to us, write to us. It's, speaking of which. So it's makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, I had a guy tweet at me the other day. He said, listen, what you have to do is you have to spell your name when you give your Twitter handle because people don't get it otherwise.
Oh,
so it's at,
true.
Which would be A-T-K-A-I-R-Y-S-S-D-A-L. That's me. Okay. And Molly Wood, I think, probably is easy enough.
That's pretty straightforward. Okay. Man, I never thought of that before. Yeah. That is awesome feedback, because even when I've occasionally tagged you in Facebook things or like Instagram, people, I have had them not only say that's what he looks like, but oh, that's how you spell his name, because it doesn't look kind of like it sounds. It's really true. Okay. Now, by the way, forever in my mind, I have now fixed you in an image, like an image of you on a giant empty lawn. All the kids off Kai's lawn. That's it.
I'm just saying.
He's just hanging out with no headphones on his huge empty lawn.
That's right. Maybe a couple of big
dogs. It's a heck of a nice lawn.
I don't know. We got to go.
We'll be back next week, everybody.
We will, for real, Stu. It's you.
I'm doing it. I'm on it. I just was rocking out. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson. Vanessa Smith helped us tremendously with our Columbia River Bar research. And senior producer Nancy Pagali, who's just always awesome. This week's program was engineered by Brian Allison. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitar Nieves, even though she is on vacation this week. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. This is the one! Yay, you guys! That's awesome! Yay! Listen, just give it. Just listen for a second. Send you out on a little high, that's all.
Our gift to you.
I'm still not going to run with that music, though.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.